My name is Sasha Lilly. I'm joined by Moshe Levine, who for many years was professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. He's the author of many books on the USSR, including The Gorbachev Phenomenon, Russian Peasants and Soviet Power, and most recently, The Soviet Century, which is the subject of our conversation today. In the late 1930s, Stalin instigated the mass arrests of up to a million Soviet citizens accused of being so-called enemies of the people, preceded in the previous year by show trials of some of the leading figures of the Bolshevik Party, Bukharin, Zinoviev, and Kamenev, amongst others. What was the purpose of what has come to be known as the Great Purges? Why did they take place?
Because Stalin was not the founder of this party. And therefore, the real history of the party was always a menace against him. And the real history of the party was sitting in Trotsky, Zinoviev, and Kamenev, and Bukharin. They were all Leninists. They were all in the erstwhile leadership. And so here was the ending, once and forever, with the finishing with this communist part, the Bolshevik party, because this was planned. It took him a long time, a certain time, and decided he has to eliminate all the traces of the thing that was called the Bolshevik party. And that's what he's doing. First for the leaders, and a little bit later for the whole cadre, is about 700,000. That is how it works. Purges are the part. It is both to eliminate from the past and to prevent a formation of some menace for him in the future. That's how it operates, and this is the key thing he's doing. It is exactly, it's so similar to Ivan the Terrible that it's unbelievable. So Stalin is a continuation and an image of this past. You were just mentioning this, but this past had only so much, so long to live, because after his death, Russia opens an entirely different passage because it's ready for it.
The 1930s were a time of enormous political and social upheaval in the Soviet Union. Can you describe what the society looked like in the 1930s and what were the social pressures that this flux created in turn?
The main things are the collectivization of the peasants, as you remember. The collectivization of the peasants, in other words, forcing them from villages into kolkhozes.
And those were the collective farms.
The collective farms, mm-hmm. Yes. Here it was a massive and very forceful pushing them into those kolkhozes and eliminating all the better off and sending them, the killing many, and sending them to the north, either 600 or 8,000 or 800,000 families. A mass terroristic action against almost the bulk of the nation. And the result was that the agriculture was actually devastated for a long period of time. What was more impressive and more important was the building of factories and big factories. That was successful. That was actually very impressive in the world. But what appeared at that time already is the use of forced labor on these building sites, which is the basis for the making of a gulag. You see, everything, all the sinister things appear and become part of the system in the 1930s.
Well, you were brought to the Soviet Union during World War II, and you worked as a collective farm worker. And you write in your book, The Soviet Century, that the collectivization of agriculture, which you have been speaking about a moment ago in the early 1930s, which was so barbaric, that it created a hybrid system that was doomed to fail. Why do you think that is?
It is based on a modern economic system cannot be permeated with violence to such an extent, or to any extent. So therefore you build things that are promising, There's nothing wrong in producing a sovkhoz, in other words, a state farming organization like a factory. Why not? But when everything is based on forcing on these people, of not paying them, of not allowing them to move, to change the job, almost on something that is even more complicated than serfdom, then this is unproductive by definition, because it kills the people, and people who are treated in such a way cannot be performing. So therefore, Stalin, when he wants somebody to perform, like when he wants the planes, good planes for or the when he wanted the rockets and the atomic bombs, then he puts this specialist almost very often, almost in a situation of a labor camp. But there's plenty of food. He bribes them, he pays them, he is pampering them when he wants atomic bombs, because this will not appear otherwise. A system based on this sort of methods is unproductive by definition. So what does happen is, nevertheless, the quantitative aspect sooner or later does give certain amount of factories, certain amount of productivity, certain amount of science. But on this road is a road of enormous and absolutely unnecessary waste. And unfortunately, from here, the element of the attitude towards resources that is very sloppy remained also after Stalin. There was always, till the very end of the system, a lot of waste of people and of resources and of the skill of specialists, etc., etc. It's very much improved after Stalin, very much. It became a very different country.
Stalin got his second lease on life, in a way, with the Soviet Union's victory in World War II, for which the USSR paid an enormous price. During and after the war, the official political rhetoric of the Soviet Union switched from defense of the socialist state to defense of the glorious Russian motherland. Can you describe that change and why you think it took place?
So that is for him to present himself to the Russian people as a Russian leader. He had always a problem with him being a Georgian, with him having a Georgian accent, and fearing that the Russians somewhere will not accept him. And, you know, if things take on a certain mood or a certain attitude, spread over large masses, no police will help you. So he was, during the war already, and especially after the war, he went straight for a old-fashioned Russian nationalism and Russian chauvinism. He forgot entirely that this country is the USSR, and he praised the great Russian nation, not mentioning all the others. And then he began also in after the war, he began to cater to the nationalist and anti-Semitic elements in the population, trying to appear ever more Russified before these masses of people. But at the same time, this is important, he entirely lost the capacity to rule. He didn't know what to do, there was no policies, because he wasn't allowing any policy to emerge without him, and he didn't know what to do at this moment. He was already, as a ruler, finished. And he was thinking only how and when will he eliminate all the other members of the Politburo, the next purge. And they all knew this.
My guest is Moshe Levin, author of The Soviet Century and Emeritus Professor of History at the University of Pennsylvania. And my name is Sasha Lilly. I want to switch things to the period after Stalin's death, which lasted for almost 40 years. In 1956, Khrushchev gave his secret speech revealing the crimes of Stalin, which led to a thaw from the systemic paranoia you've been describing of the Stalin era, and created a new period of flux in the 1960s. What were the characteristics, both political and social, of this period?
What you see in this period is, first of all, the weight of the blockage that the Stalinist period put on the development of the country. Once they took it off, and this country that had a great potential. He proved it during the 50s and 60s and 70s, because first of all began an extremely modern and very impressive process of a massive massive urbanization. In other words, massively going away from the rural past. You don't need more than a hint to see what goes away, because all these social and other traditions related to the overwhelming presence of the of a pretty primitive peasantry were going away. By the mid-1960s, the majority of the Russians live already in towns. And people who live in towns get education, although they were giving by then the education also to the peasantry. Now, therefore, urbanization of this kind is an entry into a new era. That is not the same social structure.
Which is a tremendous change, right, from the period...
Tremendous. Yeah, but I always like to quote as an example the position of the women in all this. For instance, the majority of the students of universities, and universities were present everywhere and numerous, the majority of the students were girls. 40% of the science workforce were women. He said they were not present very much in politics, because this was still the old-fashioned men's job. Very few in politics, but in education, in science, and their level of education was excellent. And this is characteristic, of course. This is special for liberated Russia. By liberated, I mean liberated from Stalinism. So that was one element. The other element that is very important, that the situation of a labor man, in other words, a working person, who under Stalin was a serf, because he didn't have the right to quit. If he left the job without authorization, he was considered a labor, like a war crime.
Mm-hmm. A deserter.
So this is serfdom. No trace of this. No sign of this. This disappeared entirely, because by now there are new codes, labor codes, etc., etc. The worker can go. There are rules. He writes. He says, "I have to go away. Give 3 weeks for warning, and that's it. And off you go." And so, therefore, the Russian population by then, from the point of view of its freedom of movement, is entirely free. They go when they want. They go where they want. They can sue the bosses in the factory. That's entirely new. And they learned how to sue them, because the new labor legislation, criminal legislation, allows them to do this, and they really learned to do this. In the hundreds and the thousands of cases, when they sue their bosses or sue the organization or sue who knows what, well, that is a different world. The role of law also becomes very important. Every university has a department of law. So these were changes that fitted a developing and a pretty viable urban society. The urbanization also indirectly reaches the countryside, because they come often to cities. The family of the peasantry changes into a cellular.
A nuclear family?
A nuclear. Because previously they were large, and so therefore there was a power of the father was almost like a little tsar, etc. And here is a husband, wife, 2 or 3 kids, and that's it. And this changes also quite a lot in the relations inside the peasantry, modernizes them, and also schools everywhere. Rural lads can easily find work in the cities, and also they make it to the universities too. These are important changes, no joke, because the past, a certain past, socially speaking, culturally, socially speaking, goes away. So here comes, therefore, the moment when the political leadership has to readapt to this. And there is a readaptation to some kind. For instance, I gave exactly all the necessary numbers about what kind of police activity how many people were arrested, how many people were, whether somebody is shot, etc. So we discovered that the shooting is disappeared entirely, that the politics of controlling the political behavior changes entirely. The country is not a democracy. No one claims this, continues to be. And in fact, my book asked the question, what was this system? And I concluded that this was one of the forms of what I call of bureaucratic absolutism. But compared to a despot of Stalin, the changes are so enormous that it is actually, in this framework, by now a pretty modern country.
And when you say bureaucratic absolutism, do you mean it's neither capitalist nor socialist?
No, it's not about capitalism. It's about the political. Because you must, when you talk about the economy, you must eliminate taking seriously the term socialism. This is the mythology that they project. Ownership of this means of production by the state is not a socialist principle. Period. People in the West and somewhere else accepted it as if it were. This is the medieval principle. The Tsar owned all the lands of the country. He was the owner of everything. Is it socialism? No, it is a thing that had nothing to do with socialism. It was a medieval principle, and it had to be eliminated quickly. But this system, looking at itself as socialist, was afraid that if it allows any other but this planned non-market economy, then it will lose the economy and the control over the economy. So the socialism will go away. In fact, there was no socialism there, not 5 minutes.
And would you define then socialism as the ownership of the means of production by the society at large rather than the state?
By society. In other words, socialism is a step forward from a capitalist democracy. Because in capitalism, there's enormous influence of capital on the state, on the political system, and money plays an enormous role in it. So therefore, the critics from the socialist point of view want to deepen the democracy, produce a situation in which the democratic principle controls the economic forces and not the other way around. But this has nothing to do with nationalizing massively and transform it into an administrative economy, and the results are good of this type, are good for wars, because it's mobilizational. But for peacetime, it has only very limited use for a time, and then it will end up, like in the Soviet Union, in an enormous process of wasting resources.
And that process of wasting resources seems to have heightened in the last decades of the Soviet Union. This period of the 60s seems to be the heyday of the system. But in the last decades under Brezhnev, things became increasingly stagnant.
That's exactly so. The 60s are interesting because also these are years of an enormous intellectual upheaval there. Upheaval not in the sense of against, allowed. In other words, there was the Prime Minister Kosygin was behind very hectic, very interesting, and entirely public debates about the state of the economy, the need in reforms, etc., etc., etc. But no reforms occurred. He saw quite clearly, very early, this was a man with a mathematical head, and he knew that the Soviet planned economy was transforming itself into a planned method of wasting resources. The Russian term was ekonomika rabotala naval. In other words, the economy worked for the waste because they were pouring money into ever new factories that were never completed or never built at all. You realize that it's as ridiculous a waste and the accusation of the system that is doing it as you can invent. This was tragic and comical. And this could be repaired, and there were enough economists and enough able officials. And then the blockage came from the political system, and here again it repeats the capacity of blockage the Tsarist regime had. Here again there is this belch from the past, and this belch from the past and the reactionary aspect of it is in the apparatus, in the way how it's governed, and the incredible power of the Politburo, that exactly like the little Tsar, if no one, as long as he stands there, he says niet, it's niet. And the same was with this belch of Tsarism in the structure of the Politburo, in which the general secretary says no, it's no, and the country doesn't move. The country is sinking. He doesn't understand it. He says no. So I think that the structure of the rule that ends up in somebody one being that capable of blocking everything, everything positive, I mean, that is a continuation of the Tsarist tradition.
So you're saying that the absolutist bureaucracy, this legacy that you mentioned, that the political consequences of that sort of system strangled the economy?
Strangled the whole system. But in my opinion, as you follow this way how I argue, is that the society matured and the political system did not. So the blocking elements were in the political system. For instance, in the fact that in real terms there was no political party at all. I got extremely hateful letters from many people after the book, because I said there that the Bolshevik Party was democratic. They don't understand what it means. I mean, in the Bolshevik Party, even during the Civil War, they were coming to the every year a conference, a congress, and debates. But they were used to this. That was the Bolshevik Party. And it is this party that could not have been ruled by a Stalin type, and he destroyed it. But that is what it was. In later years, and even in those heady and interesting 60s and 70s, the political party did not exist. It was a fiction. Because everything, even every nomination, was did not depend on real elections of any kind. Everyone was fixed from above. In other words, they did not have a party. The strongest element in the system turned out to be their bureaucracy that was running this economy. And this bureaucracy was an enormous power. I described it, I don't remember how much I described, but they were working in those factories and behaving ever more and more running, the directors, the ministers and the directors, running it ever more and more as a piece of private property. And the Politburo saw, Politburo realized, Politburo understood that all these bureaucrats transform this whole economic system, supposedly planned, into a proto-market system in which they develop ever more and more a sense of them wanting to own it. And I call this process in which the political party, so to speak, was actually, they were deprived of this property. In other words, at a certain moment, they really lost in a place where supposedly everything belonged to the state. The state lost control and was deprived of the actual ownership by the de facto situation in which the bureaucracy that was running these factories found itself. It transformed it into a hidden and semi-illegal market system, plus mafias, plus all kinds of organizations of black markets, etc., etc. The economy was entirely transformed, and the bureaucrats running it became proto-owners of it. And you see already how suddenly in one night the Soviet system will disappear. And the reason is they did not have a real political party. Because if they had a real political party, not a name, the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, these words don't mean anything. A party member didn't have political rights there. He did not have any influence over politics. He did not have a voice, because people were in any case nominated for a big job, and no one asked the membership. Had they had a party, they could save the situation. But there wasn't a political party there, only a fiction, mythology all over. When the onslaught against them by the bureaucrats began, They had nothing to put against this enormous multi-million, I mean, there were 4 million of them, of this all kind of officials, etc., in the whole system. And they had nothing to put against them. So suddenly it was taken over. The communist system was expropriated, and that was the end of it.
A lot has been written about how much of the left around the world, including in the U.S., was uncritical of the Soviet Union during the height of Stalinism, finding excuses for the Moscow trials, supporting communist attacks on the left in Spain during the Civil War, and so on. And now the political pendulum has swung so far in the other direction that now many people think there is nothing to be learned from the Soviet experience. And yet, in my opinion, not coming to terms with its legacy is one of the reasons that the left now has a hard time articulating what it is for, not simply what it's against. So I wanted to ask you, what lessons do you think the left in particular today can draw from the Soviet experience?
First of all, adoption of the Soviet system by the left in the 1930s is a result of the crisis in which the West found itself. On one hand, therefore, there's this enormous crisis of Western capitalism, and a country that calls itself socialist built like crazy, extremely impressively, and employs American unemployed engineers, etc. So what is the conclusion of those observers of the left? That it is true, we will both agree, that this country, the Soviet Union, was not building capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't capitalist, that's true. But non-capitalism doesn't mean that it is socialism. You cannot define an object by what it is not. But seeing in it a socialist adventure is actually an enormous error.
And that was a conversation I had recently with Moshe Levine. His last name is spelled L-E-W-I-N. He's the author most recently of The Soviet Century, as well as The Gorbachev Phenomenon, The Making of the Soviet System, and the recently reissued Lenin's Last Struggle. Moshe Levine was a collective farm worker in the USSR and a Soviet soldier, and after a groundbreaking career in Soviet studies, he's emeritus professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. You can find links to his books on our website, againstthegrain.org.